as Carl Jung also said, I know I quote him a lot, but he said people will do anything to avoid facing their own soul. And we do, I mean, you walk anywhere. In the moment of stillness, what do? Pull out our phones to not be still. I hadn't dealt there, so I went deep into stillness to find more peace.
Akshay, it's an absolute honor to sit down with you here today because I got an email from my buddy Zach Bitter yesterday who said, I have a buddy who's in town through Friday and is about to embark on a huge project where he will ski across Antarctica, which requires pulling a 400-pound sled. He has done all sorts of crazy shit to prepare, including a 10-day darkness retreat. And I was like, what's this guy's name? Then I look into you, and you're a United States Marine veteran, a speaker, an entrepreneur, an ultra runner, and an author, and you served in Iraq during Operation Iraqi Freedom. So thank you for your service, sir, and thank you for taking your life into your own hands and becoming a person who is worthy of increasing their own consciousness. That's a rare thing to sit in front of someone who is doing that on a consistent basis. So thank you for doing that.
Oh, I appreciate the acknowledgement, man. Thank you, brother.
So I'd love to start at that place of increasing your consciousness because you said in a 2019 interview with Dr. Michael Gervais, you said, I'm doing the same things I was doing 7 years ago, but I'm doing it from a different level of consciousness. The things that I'm doing are an access point to a greater evolution. It's not running away from the demons, it's running toward them. When did that shift? When did you start running towards the demons instead of running away from them?
So when I came back from Iraq, I was struggling a lot. I was diagnosed with PTSD, heavy drinking, like a bottle of vodka a day. I would do this for days on end, throw up in the toilet, wake up, keep drinking. Until one morning, I was on the verge of suicide after 5 days of binge drinking, seconds away from slitting my wrists. And before I even got there, I was doing a lot of these explorations of the edge, like soon after coming back from Iraq, or right when I came back, I went mountaineering in the Himalayas, climbed Kilimanjaro, started running ultras. I did a one-month crossing of Greenland, dragging a 190-pound sled for 350 miles in temperatures as low as minus 40 degrees. So I was playing on these edges, but I didn't realize this at the time. I was doing all of this to seek out an intense environment where I didn't have to be still with my demons from the war. Everything I could to run back into, there's a strange peace you get in war, in intensity when you have to confront life or death or be in this very, very intense space and you're battling yourself to just thrive and survive in an environment like that. And I was seeking out that intensity. I actually even went and got my master's in journalism so I could go back to war as a combat journalist. Everything I could to go back there. After I hit rock bottom, when I was on the verge of suicide, that was the moment where I realized something needed to change. Clearly, I mean, I was in a bad way. And I started delving deep into neuroscience, into psychology, into spirituality. And that's what then led me to being still and confronting my own demons from the war, facing them and engaging them in order to transform my relationship to them. Meaning, they don't always go away, especially some of the more intense things we experience in life. Like, for example, when I was in Iraq, my vehicle drove over an active bomb that didn't explode.
Wow.
My friend, when he was in Iraq, or one of my best friends, he drove over an active bomb, it did explode, and he was killed. When I came back, I struggled with that. I didn't get shot. I didn't lose any limbs. Why do I get to live? He didn't. Why do so many others suffer more than I do? And I struggled with survivor's guilt. I lost a couple of junior Marines to suicide. I didn't like being in crowds. I struggled with loud noises. The normal world was too much for me, right? So that's why I started seeking the escape from that. But when I started healing, I started to find value in my demons. So for example, the guilt that I felt. Everybody told me not to feel guilty. Therapists, friends, family. I get it. Rationally, I get it. You can't control what happens in war. Nobody can. Emotionally, it didn't make the guilt go away. And the realization that hit me was guilt was not a bad emotion as it's often framed. Guilt was just an expression of love for my brother in arms. And instead of demonizing as bad and trying to eliminate it, I reframed it. So for a long time, I put a picture of my friend that I lost in the war up on my wall. And it said, this should have been you. Earn this life. My guilt became my ally. That's what drove me to writing my book, Fearvana, to helping others navigate their own demons, to transcend their fear, to transcend their struggle. And that moment was the transition where I now started playing on the edges, but no longer to run away from those demons because I had faced them I had used them as fuel, and I started seeking out new edges as an access point to enlightenment, to a next new awakening, to growth, to evolution.
What does that actually look like? You saying to yourself, I want to get closer to stillness.
At first, when I first started doing the work, it was often just meditating, initially talking to a therapist, therapists were great souls, really wanted to help, but I found that their methodologies were deeply flawed. So just confronting myself, being still with my soul, journaling, I had to deal with that stuff from the war and bring it to the surface. Carl Jung, in one of my most favorite quotes, he says, until you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life and you will call it fate. So initially it was that, but a few years after all of this happened, I went through a very challenging divorce. Without going too deep into it, my ex-wife got caught up in a cult essentially, and our marriage ended. I broke my sobriety after that happened again, and not her fault. I take responsibility, of course, but that time I realized that I had done a lot of physical challenges at this point, like, you know, all the mountaineering, pushing my edges, running ultras, but something was still missing. So I wanted to go deeper into stillness, and that's what led me into the darkness retreat, where I spent 7 days in a completely dark room, and so dark you cannot see your hand in front of you, just sitting in a very, very small room alone to be still and to see what arises within. Because when you're confronting that level of stillness, you are opening doors within your own soul that have never been opened before. And that's what drew me to the darkness, because in the darkness, you're shutting off one of the primary ways we engage with reality, our visual sense. So even in the smallest way right now, I can look at that and say, that's a white wall. But now my consciousness has somewhere external to go, right? That white wall. In darkness, you have nowhere external to go. So you're forced to go within. And I wanted to go deeper within to see what would reveal itself.
So are those two different times in your life? First, when you saw a therapist, and then the darkness
retreat? Yes. To clarify. So that was much earlier on, before I was still married at the time. And I started, I went through a lot of the healing work. I had sobered up before the marriage ended. The darkness retreat happened after my divorce. So at that point, I had done a lot of that inner work, you know, sitting still with the self, as I said, and also just researching and reframing how I view trauma, my own relationship to trauma. For example, right, like I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. And as I started doing all this work, I realized that post-traumatic stress does not mean post-traumatic stress disorder. Those are two very different things. For example, I was hypervigilant of loud noises. I spent 7 months in an environment where loud noises meant death. Inevitably, I was hypervigilant. That's not a disorder. That's a normal human response to war. And when we add the word disorder, we now create that identity around ourselves. That is who I am. There's something wrong with me. Instead of actually accepting the isness of the response, we now demonize it as something bad because it means I have a disorder. And so what I started to do was reframe that relationship and acknowledge that, yes, I have post-traumatic stress, but that does not mean it's a disorder. I can choose to do something else with it. And when we reframe that paradigm, post-traumatic stress can lead to post-traumatic growth as well. To make that very concrete, there's an example that Buddha illustrates. Buddha said we're all stabbed by the two darts of suffering. The first dart is the one we don't control. So I come back from war. There's a loud noise. I'm hypervigilant. I jump. I'm jumpy. I didn't choose that response. That is beyond my control. The second dart is what we do with that. Oh, there's something wrong with me. This is a disorder. And we demonize it, right? Like I've taken a lot of people navigating fear. That's kind of my whole thing with Fearvana. And like I took a friend, it was actually my ex-wife, rock climbing, and she was super nervous on the climb. Eventually, we got to the top, came back down, was driving away. And she said to me, you know, what's wrong with me? I was so scared. You weren't scared at all. And she was beating herself up for feeling fear. The only reason I didn't feel fear was not because I was any braver. It's because I was a climber. I had more references to say this wall doesn't warrant fear. My brain said this was easy for me because I had done a lot more. It took no courage on my part to make that climb. It took courage on her part because you can't have courage without fear. The problem was not the fear, it was her beating herself up around that fear. And we all do this, right? I've worked with people who have anxiety and say, I should not feel this way. I should not feel stress. I should not feel anxiety. I should not feel fear because fear is a bad emotion, or I should not feel guilt. The truth is there are no bad emotions. There are no good emotions. There's only emotions. And it's up to us to decide what we do with them.
How do we get better at recognizing that?
The first step is to accept the first dart. That builds on the foundation of self-awareness. So it's often as simple as you could set an alarm on your phone every hour and pause and say, what am I feeling? I'm feeling fear. neuroscience has actually shown, and I go way deeper this into Fear of Vana, so without going too deep into it right now, but neuroscience has shown that we can, when we label the emotion, it increases activity in the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain related to focus and awareness, and decreases activity in the limbic brain. Essentially what that means in the emotional brain, it creates a space between the emotion and you as the feeler of that emotion, so you can respond to it instead of reacting to it. So when you start with awareness of what is, and then the acceptance of what is, it's okay to feel fear. It's okay to feel stress. It's okay to feel anxiety. These are not bad emotions. When you stop the demonization, you accept what is, got it, I'm feeling it. Like as an example, I was working with one lady and she was going through a PTSD from the, or post-traumatic stress to be more accurate, from the Boston bombing. And she felt very hypervigilant around loud noises. And so we were kind of navigating things with her and I said, I want you to, next time you feel that loud noise, just pause and be with it. And she goes, but that's really hard. And I go, I know it's hard. And it's not her fault, but most of us are looking for the quickest, easiest path because it's hard to navigate and to sit with the discomfort. There are some emotions that are more challenging than others, but they're not bad. So you have to sit with it, be with it. The only way out is through awareness and then acceptance of what is. Acceptance of the isness is everything. When you stop demonizing and just accept what is, from that place, you can now build off of it. You can choose to make guilt valuable. You can choose to make fear valuable. You can choose to make any emotion valuable.
It's like living in that story of scrolling is bad is so unconscious often,
yeah,
that, you know, when you say to someone, well, what is scrolling giving you? What are the benefits, right? It's more knowledge. It's more information. It's like if I said you spent this amount of time reading and this amount of time scrolling, you would instantly think I did something wrong by scrolling this amount.
Yeah.
It's like that's not how it works.
Yeah.
You're gaining information and knowledge. Maybe it's more dispersed. Maybe it's quick hitters. Mm. But regardless, it's the judgment of that holds us back so often.
Exactly.
What are you still judging yourself for?
Great question. Where I – and this is a construct of my reality that I've chosen to ascribe to – that is of value. And that is, I believe I owe a debt for this life I've been gifted. Mm. I believe, like, I not only did my vehicle not explode in Iraq, right? But I was born to great parents in India. I didn't really know suffering till I joined the Marines and sought it out, right? Couldn't have asked for a better life. Good parents. I mean, granted, I was kind of a fuck up in high school, did a lot of drugs, lost 2 friends to addiction, but I didn't really know suffering. And then I right now, you know, now I've worked with survivors of sex trafficking. I've worked with former child soldiers. Mm-hmm. I've been to leper colonies. I've seen the depths and hardships of poverty. I've been to war, volunteered in post-conflict zones. And when you see people who are born in hell on earth, just simply for being born where they are born, they are thrust into hell. I was blessed with a lifetime more opportunities, a million times more opportunities, simply by being born where I was born. I didn't do shit to earn that. In my paradigm, I believe I have to earn this life. There's a debt I owe for this life I've been gifted. Now, admittedly, a lot of people, my friends, mental health therapists, have said that is not a healthy way to look. But the point of this is not to say you have to think where I think. The point is our darkness has fuel. That is my demons, because of all these life experiences I've had, seeing humanity at its worst, seeing the evils of humanity, right? Seeing the struggles of humanity, not only without, but also confronting it within in my own demons. I've turned that darkness into valuable fuel. And we all have our stuff. We all have our darkness. We all have our demons. They don't have to paralyze us. They can be used as fuel. You know, Carl Jung also says, one does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. So I do hold that paradigm within, but it is useful. Hmm. Like there are times when I'm in the suck of training for a polar expedition and I'll be hurting and I'll say, you owe a debt for this life. Suck it up. Earn this. Hmm. You know, even as a very concrete example, a few years ago, I did a 167-mile run across Liberia. It was about a marathon a day for a week to help raise funds for the school. Fourth day of the run, I get this aching pain in my shin. I'm about 17, 18 miles into the run. And it just wouldn't go away. So I tried to massage it. It was not going. So I started limping because I had to hit at least 25 miles that day. And I was limping. And after limping about for a mile and a half, I then start booking it, just sprinting. And the whole time I'm saying things to myself like, remember Neil? Neil's my buddy who died in the war. It should have been you that died instead of him. Suck it up. If you quit now, you deserve a coward's death. People are suffering all around you. Liberia's been through Ebola, poverty, civil war. Look at their suffering. Earn this life. Earn it. And I was saying these very dark things to myself. But that darkness was fuel. That was the fastest few miles I ran the entire trip. When you tap into the darkness, you can use it as a weapon. This is not to say I always talk to myself like that. Other times it's very blissful, light, celebrating gratitude, looking at the gift in the world. But now you have the weapon when you play on both edges to access it and use it as you need.
How do you know when is the appropriate time to use that negative or the dark talk to yourself?
You have to step into your arena to experiment and play and to figure out. I've made mistakes around that. I did one ultra marathon. It was about an 80-mile run. And I put all these very dark audiobooks on my iPod that they were like, there was a story of a Holocaust, a survivor of sex trafficking, a former child soldier. And the thought process was, I'll listen to this dark stuff when I'm like deep in the suck of this ultra. And I will remember my pain is nothing compared to their pain. But I went into the suck and it was night. And this was like a self ultra. It wasn't a huge race. It was just me alone out there. And I started listening to this and I got into such a dark space. I went into like, humanity sucks. The world is evil. Everything sucks. The world is horrible. And I was like, all right, that was not effective. So you have to experiment to know, but that comes with being in the arena, practicing, training, and then you start to recognize which tool, which weapon is most valuable for you as and when you need it.
Yeah. And I think generally speaking, people are more in the dark than they are in the light in terms of how they're talking to themselves, mm-hmm. like just you versus you. Mm-hmm. And so what have you found to be the mantras or the ways to talk to yourself to get into the light space?
Yeah, to that point, you know, psychologically, we have the negativity bias. So we're wired to think in the negative. And I myself was like that. I would run 10 miles and be pissed off I didn't run 13. Ran 13, be pissed off I didn't run 20. Always beating myself up until I realized I was just activating misery in my life. You know, so I started just celebrating the wins more.
How?
As simple as, nice job, you crushed it today. Yeah. Like, as a, you know, like last... 2 weeks ago, it was my 39th birthday. So to celebrate, I did a 39-hour week of endurance that ended with 3 back-to-back 9-hour endurance days. So it was 2 9-hours of tire dragging, which is a very heavy truck tire. It's training for Antarctica, and then a 9-hour hike. Now, even then, my instinct was to, where could you have gone harder? And that's a valuable tool, but you don't want to define it, right? So immediately I was like, nice job, you crushed that, celebrating the win, you know? So when I'm in that, or when I'm in the suck of it, I'm just simply, especially with tire dragging, it's very slow and monotonous. So it's pausing to acknowledge, like, what do I need right now? And sometimes it's gratitude. Like, I get to choose my suffering. That's a privilege. Or I get to be here. One of the things that's invaluable to me is, in the depths of suffering, you get to access transcendence over that suffering. Like, to me, suffering is a training ground for transcendence, which is the access point to God, right? However, we all have our own version of what God means. But when do people come or attempt to come closest? In the depths of hell, right? In war, we used to say there's no atheists in foxholes. So when you're in pain, you have to transcend to move through that pain. So when I'm in the suck, I sometimes remind myself, this is why you are here. Like, this is the gift. This is what place that I call the moment. If you didn't want to be here, why would you drag tires for 9 hours? You know, why would you do any of these things? So this is the moment you get to touch the hand of God. And these experiences have been blessed to do, from 10 days in darkness. After the 7 days, I went back to 10 days in darkness and pushing these edges, ultras. I mean, it is my version of what I believe God to be. It's the closest I've ever come. And it is profoundly beautiful. So I simply reframe how I view suffering and just gratitude, like pure gratitude, not even just like, oh, I feel grateful. It's, I know that I feel the essence of gratitude in the depths of my soul. And that activates awe for this human experience.
Why is endurance spiritual?
Because of the endurance sports, what draws me more than any others is the time factor. When I go to the gym for 30 minutes and just go all out and I hit session, it's hard, I suffer, I'm sweating, whatever, maybe 30 minutes, 45, but you kind of know it's ending very quickly. When you go for a 9-hour, a 24-hour run, or 110 days in Antarctica as it's coming up, if you let your mind go to the future, you will break. You will break. I've done a 24-hour run before, right? And you can't be thinking about that. When I have my 110-day journey across Antarctica coming up, I can't be thinking about 110 days on day one, or I'm going to break before it even goes out there. So the element of that, of time, adding into the fact that you're kind of in the suck pretty relentlessly when you're doing an endurance. Yes, there's moments of bliss, but it forces you, or it makes you have to confront your mind to bring yourself back into the present. And that is a very spiritual experience, especially when I do it. That's why I love a polar traveler, going out in nature, because out there, you know, nature becomes a mirror to the soul. When nature is hostile, it doesn't act out of malice. Unlike human beings, we do a lot of evil shit to each other. Nature is hostile in this place. It's like Antarctica. Hurricane force winds, minus 40 degrees. I've lost two fingers to frostbite. It's unforgiving. But it's not acting out of malice, or it's not, it has no intention. It simply is. The isness of that acts like a mirror for you to see yourself. And that's the of such a spiritual experience to activate that. You know, when you're out there too, you feel all of life's dualities coexisting as one. And what I mean by that is, in the human experience, there are a series of dualities that encompass life. There's masculine, feminine, life and death, light and dark, ego, humility, contentment, discontentment, stress, recovery, pain, pleasure, a series of them. When you're out in nature, you see these forces coexisting as one. And often in life, we demonize one side as bad. Stress is bad. The darkness is bad. But neither side is bad or good. They both have their place. You cannot really know the light unless you've been in the dark. In nature, you get to see. That's why endurance, especially in nature, is such a spiritual experience of seeing oneness of all that is. Like when I'm in Antarctica, you feel so humble. You are small compared to this massive playground around you that is unforgiving. You have no control over it. It will break you in a second. You never conquer the mountain or conquer Antarctica, right? And it will humble you in its raw power. But at the same time, in that humility, you will never feel as powerful as you do there simply by choosing to step into that playground and going to war with yourself in that playground. You tap into a raw power that each of us has within, and you get to experience it at its finest on that edge. And so these playgrounds of endurance in nature especially, but you can do it anywhere, right? It allows you to see all these forces coexisting as one, and that oneness is, I mean, it's a moment of enlightenment. It's a moment of awakening, of touching God to see that. You know, and again, it doesn't have to be Antarctica. Like even in the darkness, for example, and when you're in extended darkness, your brain starts to release DMT. So you see lights that are as real as any lights here.
Wow, really?
The brightest light I've ever seen in my life was in a dark room. Wow. It was so bright.
When?
It was on the day 4 of the 7-day darkness retreat. Wow. But even both times I did the darkness, you're consistently seeing light. In this darkness, it was so bright, I was covering my eyes like this. I was touching my eyelids because I couldn't tell if they were open or closed. It was blinding. I was literally trying to shield myself. And there you get a visceral experience of light existing in dark. Oneness.
Wow. So, okay, we need to go through so many of these experiences. What about that one? This was like the first, how would you describe this 7-day retreat? And what did you learn?
This one for me was a lot more healing. I went in there because I had broken my sobriety after the divorce, and I wanted to kind of go a little deeper within, you know, confront some more of my demons, see what arises, see what reveals itself.
Okay, wait. We'll get back there.
Sure.
I want to touch on that, on breaking your sobriety,
yeah,
when something bad happens, and you were this person, you wrote this book, and then now all of a sudden you relapse, you're back in the place, and that is almost more painful because you know you're capable of so much. What do you say to somebody who's in that position right now?
At first, just sorry, empathize with the demons of it, the struggle of it, you know, it's hard not to judge yourself. I did. You're going to judge yourself. You're going to beat yourself up. You're going to think of yourself as a piece of shit. I did. Especially I had done all these amazing things at this point, and now I go back into the pit and go back hard into the pit. And it's, you know, look, this may work for some people, but I was never one to count my days, because sometimes, like, and for a lot of people, it works to count your sober days. So awesome if that works for you. For me, it made me feel even shittier when I broke. So after coming out of the throes of it, really trying to look at what was the value in that, what was the lesson in there. You know, now I'm obviously sober, and every fall there was some new thing. I mean, had I not fallen, I might not have gone into the darkness retreat, right? I mean, again, I don't know where the road would have taken me, but it led me to seeking out. And that's the key thing, is after you start to climb back out from that pit, that abyss, you have to seek something. What is the thing that you're avoiding? I mean, addiction is ultimately it's a symptom of some pain you're avoiding, some demon you're avoiding. And for me, you know, looking back, I had done a lot of these hard things, but it was the greatest fear that I hadn't confronted. And I think it's one of the greatest fears in the human condition is stillness. I don't think if you ask somebody, what are you scared of? People would say stillness, but look at the world. We do everything we can to distract ourselves from ourselves. As Carl Jung also said, I know I quote him a lot, but he said, people will do anything to avoid facing their own soul.
Yeah.
And we do, I mean, you walk anywhere in the moment of stillness, what do? Pull out our phones to not be still. I hadn't dealt there. So I went deep into stillness to find more peace.
I spoke to a college class yesterday and they asked me for a challenge for what I should leave them with.
Mm.
And I said, spend 20 minutes alone with no stimulus.
I love it.
And the people were like, I can't do that. Are you kidding? That's crazy. And I was like, wow, like what I take for granted is an extreme for a lot of people. Okay.
You're right.
Back to yourself. You say, all right, I have a problem with stillness. I need to get to that place. I need to figure that out. Why not just a silent retreat? Why not just 60 minutes of meditation a day? Why not? There are so many things you can get to a still place.
Sure.
But you just crazy. You crazy man. You just went straight to the extreme.
At this point, I was already somebody seeking out the edges. So I went, because actually I didn't know a darkness retreat existed. So I was going to go into a silent retreat, like the Vipassana thing. And while I was researching, I stumbled into this concept. And that immediately I was hooked. Because of what I was saying earlier, you shut off the visual sense. So inevitably, you're going to go deeper. You know, so that was the draw. Because, you know, I was talking about the dualities. You want to find true enlightenment is play on all edges.
Yeah.
And I even don't even mean like the just the edge of pain and suffering like I do. Like as an example, you know, a few years ago, this was a while ago, I went for a run and I saw a sign that said 5K fun run. And I had visceral disgust at the idea of a fun run. Like not even a conscious response. It was like subconsciously, like you don't run for fun. You have to suffer every run, you know? And it was comical, but that wasn't healthy.
No.
And I realized that I was bringing in suffering in every area of my life. So I started playing on the edge of fun, like doing lighter things. I would go to retreats and I would be more uncomfortable doing a dance than I would. I could go do 100 burpees in the corner. I'd be happier. So I would do things like being light, being playful, being dancing, going for runs where I'm not counting my miles just to have fun, you know? And when you play on the edge of now fun, you not only gain new insights that you hadn't gotten before, because if you stay doing what you've always done, you're going to keep getting more of what you've always gotten. Now you're going to a new edge. Suddenly you're opening new doors. Suddenly you start to even figure out what you don't know, right? Because every one of us don't know what we don't know. So now you start to open there. And not only does that give you new tools to feel more alive in the human experience, you grow more through that, but you also get more tools to play on your playground. Like if you look at the duality of, let's call it suffering and play, semantics aside, I'm always somebody clearly who leans on the edge of suffering. That's why I do what I do. But because I've gone onto the edge of play, I have now new tools to access in my struggle.
Yeah. Well, I feel like I'm on the edge of play. So I was like, let me run a marathon. So let me suffer. You know, you need to figure out yourself.
Exactly.
And you need to figure out where are you leaning.
Exactly.
To round yourself out as a human being, because that is what we're here for. And any place you don't want to go is a place you're not free. And if you see fun run and you're like, oh,
yeah.
You're not free.
Exactly.
And that's an interesting thing. So like, how did you get to a point of suffering being your safe place?
After the Marines was where it all got birthed, because in the Marine Corps training was hard. I learned the beauty of struggle. Mm-hmm. You know, I had Marine Corps training, you learn how to move through struggle and you discover how strong you are, you know, through that. Because again, I had lived a pretty damn good life. Didn't really know suffering. Any struggle my parents went, they went extremely wealthy at the time, middle class. Now they're doing very well. But at the time when we were younger, you know, middle class, but any struggles they might've went through, I didn't know it. So the Marines taught me the beauty of suffering, and so I went deeper into that. After Marines, I got into every outdoor sport you can think of. I was scared of heights, so I went skydiving, mountain climbing, rock climbing. I was scared of tight spaces, so I went caving. I went cave diving.
Was there a first one that once you looked at it, you saw, wow, if I'm scared of something, I have to lean into it?
It was the Marines that birthed that.
Gotcha.
And then I lived in Austin. So Austin was a beautiful rock climbing playground. I was terrified of heights, went rock climbing. And eventually I was doing rock climbing without rope, you know, like free solo style. Nothing like Alex Honnold level, but high enough that you could hurt yourself if you fell, you know? So just playing on those. And the key thing is none of these, like now when people hear the things I do, they're like, how are you so fearless? I'm not fearless. Even now, Antarctica terrifies me. It terrifies me. I was more scared going on a date with my now fiance than I am doing all the crazy shit I do. I kid you not, like anxiety in my stomach going on this date.
Why?
There was a fear around dating and with women. I was never, I would call myself like a suave kind of person, especially growing up in high school. And so even with that, like I never bothered to question, got to a point, like now I'm pretty good at dealing with fear. It's kind of my whole thing. So when it's there, I don't bother to question it. I just be with it and move through it. So I was like, now we're engaged. She knows this. So I told her, you know, that even actually on that date, it was our second date. I told her later on in the date that I was terrified driving up to you.
Wow.
And that alleviated the fear, you know? So I didn't bother to question it. Now, like sometimes there's value in going deeper and understand it, but a lot of the times, who cares? The best way to use fear is to tap into it and engage it to use it to prepare better. Like one of my many mantras is fear propels you to prepare. So when you engage it, though, like even writing a book on fear, writing Fearvana was terrifying. What are people going to think about me? What if it's stupid? What if I get that dreaded 1-star review on Amazon? What if people hate it? So because I was scared, I started studying from authors like Jack Canfield, Tim Ferriss, prolific authors who've done very, very well. How do I write a better book? Now, because I was scared of writing a terrible book, I must have trashed 100,000 words worth of work, but I wrote a book that now I'm proud of that is worthy of being endorsed by the Dalai Lama and people like Jack Canfield, Seth Godin, because my fear helped me write a better book. Mm. I engaged it and literally write out, what's the worst case scenario? Whatever your fear, what am I scared of? What's the worst case scenario? How can I then prepare for it? Antarctica, I'm terrified. Worst case scenario is death. Got it. Here's how I can prepare for it, right? So you can use fear as a valuable tool to prepare better.
Yeah, and it's interesting though. Did you do that exercise when you're on the way to see your wife or your fiance for the first time, like the first date?
Not at that point. This was like just 4 months. We're now engaged, but we've only been dating 4.5 months.
Oh, wow.
So at this point I did not, because it was just like, it's there. Cool. But when writing the book, I did.
Gotcha.
When writing the book,
I did. If you considered it to be a bigger project, then you would do that exercise. Because a lot of times these fears that happen, it's like, just do it. Just like get over it. Like you feel it? Good. That's a sign that it is there for your greater freedom.
Exactly.
And it's like you should look forward to those fears. You should look forward to someone triggering you or someone getting you upset in some like
exactly.
If you get to that point, it's like the whole life becomes a way for you to expand and grow.
Exactly. And doing this exercise doesn't necessarily mean the fear will go away, to be very clear. Mm. It just gives you better tools. Like with Antarctica, I'm very much doing that. I'm preparing for every worst case scenario. It's actually a tool called negative visualization, which is not often talked about, but astronauts do this. They look at everything that could go wrong. That's a valuable place to go because that's how you prepare for it. Antarctica has serious consequences in that environment. So I'm preparing for that.
How'd you get that in your head to do that?
Learning through, you know, reading a lot of books when I was in my healing journey, recognizing, because the fundamental ethos of Fearvana and why I even wrote it was to combat the demonization of these emotions as bad. Everybody, even a lot of in the personal development world, will demonize fear as bad or anxiety as bad. And I was like, this is not helpful. This is not helpful to view emotions as bad because they're not bad. They just are. And we don't have to be defined by them. Even while writing the book, right? After writing the book, I was unknown author. Nobody knew me. And I was like, this is a very spiritual concept. Who would be a great spiritual reader to kind of leader to validate this? Yeah. Dalai Lama. Why not? You know? So I had a thought, why can't I reach out to him? And then immediately I was like, there's no way. Who am I? We all go through that thought, right? And then the thing is we don't have to listen to that thought.
Yeah.
We're not our thoughts. We're not our feelings. We're not our experiences. We are the thinker of our thoughts, the feeler of our feelings, and the experiencer of our experiences. When we transcend what is, coming back to accepting what is, to then transcend what is, now I was like, all right, maybe he won't. What's the worst case that could happen? So I reached out. I found an email for one monk there, connected me to three other monks, shared what I'm doing, shared the story of Fearvana. 5-6 months it took to build a relationship. And throughout this 5-6 months, I kept thinking, there's no way they're going to do it. Who am I? My book? What if they hate my book? All these thoughts, right? But I was able to notice the thought, but not be defined by the thought. Got it. Let me follow up with an email anyway. And thankfully, after 5-6 months, I didn't even ask for a forward. I just asked for a one-liner, but I was truly honored and humbled that the Dalai Lama wrote the forward for the book. You know, so it was a result of being with the thought, but not being defined by the thought.
Yeah. But I often ask myself, like, why do you need those thoughts in the first place? Why do you need the thought of, oh, what is he going to say? Or the thought of like, she's going to reject, like you can, there's a world that I'm living in where I don't think those thoughts. And how do you get to that place?
At first, when on the pursuit of mental mastery, it's going to show up more when you start the journey, whatever you are on your journey. And there's not going to be sort of a magical X on the ground, like now I've arrived. But now I'm at a point where doubt shows up significantly less. Mm. It still shows up a little bit, especially with something as daunting as Antarctica.
Yeah.
But I've gotten damn good at not listening to it as real. But the more you do those things, the key thing to build confidence is not only doing hard shit and transcending it, It's actually how you talk to yourself after, which is another very important component. As I said, right, I used to do 20-mile runs and be pissed off I didn't run 25 or whatever it may be. You're not then gaining the, you're not stacking the wins because you're not actually acknowledging the win was there. And as you pointed out, a lot of us do this. We're constantly beating ourselves up for this, that, and the other thing. But we're all stacking wins every single day in small ways, yeah. Right? So I then started reframing, okay, do the hard thing, and then how do I talk to myself? Another shift that happened to me, like you mentioned earlier on, right? Like I used to do things with a very different level of consciousness, and I would just jump from one hard thing to the next hard thing to the next hard thing. Now, one of my many mantras is stretch and reflect. So after I do a hard thing, I come back and reflect. What was the value in that? How will I celebrate the win in that? What did I get from that? Is that a place I want to keep going? You know, what's the learnings? How will I take this with me to the next learning? So stretch and then reflect. And that pause allows you to consolidate the memory, consolidate the events in service of your awakening to keep moving forward on the next path.
How have you grown in the last year?
The biggest growth in the last year has been, I mean, everything has been oriented towards Antarctica and training for that and the continuous spiritual mastery of that path. Two of the tools to be make it very concrete, like I've gone deep into studying method acting.
Wow.
Are you familiar?
Yeah, I am, but that surprises me, honestly. But it makes sense when you say it.
So method acting is, as you're somewhat familiar, is the like how actors will embody a character to the point that even when the cameras are not filming, they're living and breathing that character.
So you can be Ernest Shackleton?
You can be whoever you want to be, exactly. So this to me was, it is by far, and I've studied personal growth for decades, the most valuable tool for personal growth that I've ever encountered, and nobody talks about it, only actors. Like Daniel Day-Lewis, he's the greatest method actor of all time. I don't know if you've seen any of his, like he did Last of the Mohicans, he was Gangs in New York, Bill the Butcher. And Daniel Day-Lewis, when he gets into character, he actually dreams as the character. He even says this, I'll have thoughts and feelings that are not my own. One of the directors said of Daniel Day-Lewis, I've never seen somebody come to as complete obliteration of the self. And so what's the value in this for us, right? I'm not trying to act in a movie. But the foundation of this is to recognize that the self is a construct of our identity. Now, let me elaborate and explain with that. How we engage with reality is a series of constructs. In the most basic way, when I see that and I see a white wall, how do I know that's a white wall? Because I've been taught that thing I'm seeing is white and that thing is a wall. But there's a space between pure experience and us as the experiencer of that experience. And in that space is filled with all our constructs. Our constructs are the belief systems, the paradigms, everything the world has taught us, our parents have taught us, all of that, right? The first step, coming back to what we said earlier, is awareness. You start, and what I used to do, now I don't do it as much because I've now gotten a lot better. But when I was fully going down this path, every time I would drive, I would constantly be repeating the mantra, I am awakened to the truth that all of my reality is an illusion. I'm awakened to the truth that all of my reality is an illusion. And I would repeat this. And I would see a red car and be like, that's a red car. That's a construct of how I view that red car, right? And I'd be doing this throughout. First, just getting aware that my reality is a construct. Now, when I see that, I can see even my sense of identity is a construct. You know, I believe certain things about myself. Those aren't inherently real. We ascribe them as real, but when we engage with reality, we're not engaging with reality as it is. We're engaging with reality through our lens. So if I'm wearing red glasses, the world's going to look red no matter what. That's why you have people who can be two people in the same room and one guy thinks the world is terrible and the other thinks it's awesome, right? The constructs that shape our reality.
Yes.
The more you become aware of them, the more you can release them to now build whatever you want to build. That's why I went into the darkness the second time for the 10 days, which was just in the last year, is to create the character I need to be to ski across Antarctica. So one of the things I was doing was, there was a yoga mat in the darkness so you could kind of have a sense of where you're walking. Otherwise, you have nothing, right? It's completely dark and you get lost very easily. So I'd pace back and forth on the yoga mat and just talk out loud to myself. It was madness. Like if a camera was looking at me, I'd look like a fucking psycho, you know? So, and I'd be yelling, talking out loud, sometimes growling. And I would speak things that I had never said before. It was almost like I was birthing this new character. The first step, like an actor, what is the character? So for me, it's all oriented around skiing across Antarctica. What are the virtues I need? What are the traits I need? What are the characteristics I need? Who do I need to be to complete this journey? Got it. Here's a sense of who I need to be, right? Here's the quote-unquote script for me, like coming back into the parlance of actors. Okay, now, and great actors will do this. They'll actually get a script and they'll write down, they'll create a whole history of the character. What's her name? I can't remember. Anyway, she would like write down hundreds of pages of the creating literally a history of this character that she's been assigned. Got it. And now embody the physicality of the character. So Daniel Day-Lewis, for example, when he was playing Bill the Butcher, he actually learned how to be a butcher. So now the physicality is embedded into you, into your beingness. So for me, it's going out tire dragging. And sometimes I look like, again, a psycho in the park. I'll be growling to myself. I'll be entering this state, right? This place that I often refer to as the cage. And in there, I'm a different being. Now I'm embodying the physicality of it. And then eventually, as I keep doing this, you have to surrender to the character to let the character speak to you. Because you can, this version of you, if you choose who you want to be, it's limited by the constraints of this self. So it's a very subtle shift, but you will notice it when you play on these edges, when you do this Like I had days when I was going deep into this process, especially in the early days, I would wake up and feel like I'm falling off a cliff because I was off balance. Because one identity, I'm almost shedding, right? And Daniel A. Lewis, he talks about this. After every role, he went through kind of a death because he's created a new identity. And now he's had to kill that identity to go back to Daniel A. Lewis or to go to the next version of Daniel A. Lewis. So you're kind of losing parts of yourself. But the value in this process too is you get to access those parts of yourself without judging them that much easier. Like another example, before I met my fiance, I would struggle sometimes with loneliness. You know, I'd been divorced for about 4 or 5 years and I didn't want to admit that about myself, especially a guy going to 110 days across Antarctica. I don't get lonely. No, hell no. But the thing is, when I started practicing method acting, because I recognize all my identity as a construct, I could be with the loneliness and not have to ascribe reality to it. Oh, got it. It's there. Cool. Let me go deeper. Now it got me even better at releasing judgment of those constructs because I do not matter. The only thing that matters is the character I'm creating. The thoughts, the feelings, the identity, the belief systems, all that is relevant is who is the character I'm becoming.
Yeah. And also it's like, if you're in the character of I'm Ernest Shackleton and then you're looking at you, you're like, oh, that's a different guy. It's all good. That guy has insecurities. Like if I go and talk to you and you tell me you have an insecurity, when I leave you, I don't think about it.
Yeah.
There's no charge to it.
Yeah.
There's no feeling of like I'm connected to this insecurity and it's so important to me.
Yeah.
It's like that's available for you in every moment. I remember Absolutely. Telling a friend, you know, like I know you're really dealing with this problem. I don't think about that problem at all. And neither does anyone else. And that problem that you have that you're thinking about all day long, and I could tell you are, no one cares about it. And that to her was like, oh, I can share. Oh, like I see. Because when you see it in someone else, when you see their, it's easier.
Absolutely,
but this is so brilliant because I've studied personal development in some sense for the past 10 years. And other than Will Smith talking about how everyone should be and do an acting in some way, never considered this as like something to study. And that game is like changer. A huge, tears came to my eye when you said it.
I'm happy to hear that, brother. It was a game changer.
So, okay. So method acting. And you said there was a second thing.
Yeah. Great. Good to point out. The other thing that's been awesome is engaging with how memories work and using that as even part of the method acting process. So let me explain. And I go deep into the neuroscience of it in Firvana as well. But basically, when we engage with the memory, we think of it as like accessing a screen. Like I'm putting on this video camera of my 25th birthday, whatever, right? But that's not how memories work. Every time we access the memory, we are accessing the last time we accessed that memory. Mm. So the neuronal structure of that memory alters. Memories are malleable. Now, why is this important? Because how we engage with reality is based on our memories. Like, why do I know this is a thing? How do I know how to open this can? Because I have a memory of how this thing works. I know there's a drink in there. I know how to drink it. And this is just a small example, but everything. Our brain is constantly creating memories, and those memories will shape how we engage with the present and how we step into the future. Knowing this, I learned to manipulate memories, and not just in terms of the past, because part of it is to first recognize, and this is what one of the flaws with therapy was, we're always going into this past memory from a disempowered state. So all that's doing is reinforcing the content of that memory more negative and negative and negative, right? And there's a great researcher, Dr. Elizabeth Loftus, has shown how you can actually input fake memories into people. Like they did a study after 9/11. They asked people all kinds of questions, and they asked them the same questions 5 years later. And often the huge things change, not just small things, but even where they were when 9/11 happened. So their entire memory had completely shifted to like, and it's not like they were lying. They believed it because memories are not inherently true. Mm. Now, when you recognize this, it can lead to a kind of nihilism if you're not careful, and a kind of like, if nothing's true, who cares? But the point of this, if you actually see it, is to recognize that if the past is not inherently true, I'm just going to create whatever version that will serve me. So one of the things I was doing was not only reframing my past experiences, and a way to do that is like simply putting yourself in an empowered state, you know, and constantly accessing the memory of going like reframing the past experience. So that's how I altered like the relationship to all my past of the war. But even a client I was working with, you know, I would help her step into the ideal future self she wants to go into and visualize it. Really, like you're putting yourself in that neuronal state where you're feeling the positive, quote unquote, positive hormones, right? The dopamine, anandamide, the endorphins. You can do it after exercising, and from there going back into the past. And now the more you do that, the you reframe the experience. So part of it was the reframing the past, but only this year where I started kind of get this, call it a ninja hack, to actually use this in service of bettering my future, was I realized, okay, if memories work this way, I'm going to alter my the experiencing self moment of said experience in order to change how future me will think about this moment. So I'll give you an example. When I was in the Arctic earlier this year, I was on a training expedition in preparation for Antarctica. I was on solo. Every day, at the end of the day in the tent, I would smile. I would sometimes listen to positive music, and I would think about the day in a way that I wanted to think about the day. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to focus on this, that, and the other element of this event, of this memory. Second day, I'm doing the same thing. What am I doing? I'm bombarding my memory with how I wanted to think about the event, because none of it's real anyway. So who cares? I'm going to manipulate my brain knowing that this version of you, of me sitting now in front of you, thinks about the Arctic in a different way. So future me is going to think about this event a different way, and how I think about that event will shape how I then go out tire dragging or my desire to go to Antarctica, right? If I think about during the event, because let's say you're doing a really hard run, for example, and after every run, you're like, oh, this really sucks. You're imprinting a memory that this really sucks.
Yeah.
You can manipulate that. None of that shit is real, yeah, right? Memories are malleable. The brain is plastic. That's the whole science of neuroplasticity. So if that shit is not real, I'm going to manipulate my brain to have future me think about it the way I want to think about it. So using your present to inject your memory, because remember, every moment your brain is molding a memory. When you become aware of this, you can change how the future version of you thinks about anything you want to think about. This was a game-changing hack, if you want to call it that, because now every moment I get to create how future me is going to think about that moment. So literally I left the Arctic with deep excitement to go deeper into the solitude of Antarctica, because I've manipulated that memory. So this version of me sitting in front of you today thinks differently about that experience, because that experience, I manipulated it while I was experiencing it, knowing that future version of me is going to think about it.
So what does that look like exactly?
The manipulation of the present?
Yeah.
It's choosing. So if let's say it's a run, right? You come back from a run, choosing, I'm going to focus on this, that, and the other thing in the run, focusing on all the positives, imprinting the memory you want to, and it has to be with strong emotion. Emotion is what imprints a memory deeper into the subconscious. Mm. It's not always just the challenging, quote unquote, negative emotions. It's also really empowering ones. Now, the deep, dark ones stay deeper imprinted for purely evolutionary purposes, because it's more important for me to be nervous about that giant thing on the corner that could kill me than it is to miss out on a beautiful sunset, right? So inevitably, that's why things like traumatic experiences, fearful experiences get deeply embedded into the subconscious, into the amygdala, because that is more valuable for survival needs. But you can also embed those experiences, those memories, through positive, and I use positive again in quotes, of emotion. So I'm going to choose to smile. I'm going to listen to an empowered song. I'm going to put myself feeling endorphins, put myself in a very happy state, and then think about said moment. Do it over again. Do it. So every day in the Arctic, I would do this in my tent every single night, right? I'm thinking about this every day, how I want to think about it. And one of the things I was also doing even at home, because the key in this is to start to recognize that memories and entirety of how we engage with reality is that illusion, right? It's a construct. So the other day I was in my house and I was doing the simple exercise to prove, quote unquote, prove to myself that memories are a lie. Like I sat there and I looked, okay, what did I eat for dinner yesterday? I ate steak. How do you know? And I was having this very schizophrenic dialogue with myself. How do you know you ate steak? Well, you know, I remember it. Okay, but you also know, based on neuroscience, that memories are not real. So you remember it, but that doesn't mean you ate. No, I can see the steak wrapper there. How do you know that was yesterday? How do you know where that came from? Because you know memories are a lie. And enough of this psychotic dialogue with myself to just, all I have to do is to just show that I don't really know. If I have 1% doubt that I don't really know, I've now validated that all my memories are a lie. Because I could say that I do, but science, life experience, everything has validated that I don't really do, and I don't really know what I ate. Got it. If I don't really know, there's now doubt infected into the memory. Perfect. that's not a bad thing, because now I know that it's not real, so I'm going to choose to believe whatever the hell I want to believe.
But how do you then think about other people's memories corroborating with that story? So other people might have seen you eat steak. So if 20 other people say you ate steak and you have doubt in your, like, how does that work?
Awesome question. So this is where, you know, coming back to the concept we talked about, dualities. The ability of true mastery of mind is the ability to hold two conflicting thoughts in your mind at the same time and be able to coexist with that. So as an example, when I was in boot camp, in Marine Corps boot camp, there was this instance where this kid was getting punished for something he didn't do. And he was like in tears, in horrific pain. The drill instructor was making him do this exercise, like kind of on his elbows in a plank position. And he was in horrific pain. And somebody had whistled, and the drill instructor was like, who was the one who whistled? And whoever it was wasn't coming up. And there was a thought in my mind that even though I didn't do the whistle or whatever, I should step up and take the pain from that kid, because that would be the right thing to do. He was suffering, you know, and as a leader, that was the right thing to do. And I had that thought, but I was too scared and I didn't do it. That has lived with me. I feel guilty for that. So when I was in the darkness, what I did was, in the 10 days of darkness, I was like, okay, I have this memory of this experience. So I actually replicated the position. I did the same position. So I was almost able to quote unquote Photoshop, because now I have a visceral experience of me in this position. So I could Photoshop myself into that position of like taking the thing from my, and I can literally in my brain picture myself walking up and taking it, because I have viscerally experienced myself doing that. Now, I'm not going to tell you, because I know I didn't do it. So I'm not going to lie about it, obviously. But the point is, I now can validate an identity of myself that I need to validate in order to do XYZ. So this is the point of holding two conflicting thoughts at the same time. And this comes with practice. It comes with practice. Otherwise, it can feel like, wait, I know this is not true. But that's where, coming back to the point I was just saying earlier, nothing is inherently true in my memory, so who cares? If it's all an illusion, I can ascribe whatever the hell I want to this illusion. Hence the mantra, you know, how I engage with, I'm awakened to the truth that all of my reality is an illusion. And the illusion I want to ascribe to, like even that deep, you know, the deepest existential question, who am I? There is no right answer to that question. My answer to that question, after pondering this for decades, is I am the creator of my own illusion. I am the creator of my own illusion. My reality is an illusion. I'm going to create whatever the hell illusion I want that serves me, and then use that to make my life better, to make the life of people around I hope to serve better. And that is the illusion I choose to ascribe to. Mm.
That's powerful.
Thank you, brother.
I'm going to be training. I'm training currently for my first marathon.
Awesome. As I heard from Zach. Yeah.
And I'm running it on December 2nd.
Okay.
And, you know, from hearing you speak in the past, since we've started this podcast, I wanted to ask you about how I should think about the marathon itself. But now I'm starting to think maybe I should ask you about how I should prepare for this final training block in the next 3-4 weeks, because really that's the majority of the time. Hmm. And if I can change my thoughts and how I think about the training, and that could have an incredible impact on the actual marathon itself.
Absolutely.
So what is your advice, generally speaking, knowing that I'm going to be running a marathon on December 2nd, 2023?
So I would say, first off, like, yeah, in your training experience, kind of doing what I was talking about with manipulating the memory of the of said experience, you know, so as you're going through the training, like right now, how do you perceive running? Like, what's your belief around running?
I love running. Running.
Awesome.
The struggle, quote unquote struggle, makes me stronger, and the pain Perfect. That I go through is helping me evolve. It's a spiritual experience.
Awesome.
And it's helping me connect me to all things.
Awesome. So you have a paradigm that serves you.
Yes.
That's great. So now you can, you know, keep reinforcing that if need be. The other tools, like, I believe some of the four most important virtues to guide us on the path of mastery, to embody, I would say, is courage. Courage, I would argue, is probably the most important virtue.
Why?
And Maya Angelou actually says, courage is the most important virtue, because without courage, you can't practice any other virtue consistently. You can practice it erratically, but not consistently. Like, it's easy to be kind right now. What about when life is punching you in the face and you got to be kind to people around you who, let's say, done bad things? It takes a lot of courage. Courage is because life will be hard. It's always hard. And it takes courage to move through the hard thing, to move through fear. Mm. You can't have courage without fear. So you need courage. You need fear to experience courage. You need struggle to experience courage to move through that. So courage is foundational to moving through. You might have a heart, like a run where you wake up one day and you don't want to do it. That sucks. I'm really not feeling it. That takes courage to step out the door. Mm. So training in that, like anything, it's a trainable skill. The other one is presence. If you're thinking about mile 26.2 when you're on mile 1, you will break. Your mind will destroy you. So training yourself to presence. And this is as simple as walking into the coffee shop. Instead of checking your phone when you're standing in line, let me be with myself. The greatest way to bring yourself back into presence is to anchor into your five senses, one of the five senses. So simple hack, right? Courage, presence, curiosity. I cannot stress enough the value of curiosity to navigate life's hardships, because often we have like a judgment, or people will say, don't compare yourself to others, which I think is useless advice, because the brain naturally does compare yourself to others. So instead of saying don't compare, when you find yourself comparing, inevitably, we all do this, right? Instead of being, and people will do this, like I had made a comment on Instagram the other day about how me and my fiance, we never fight. I can't tell you how much that triggered, and we never will fight. I said, we'll never fight. That triggered the shit out of people. Like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. He's naive. He's stupid. I can't tell you how much it triggered people. Now, here's the thing. You can have your judgment. You can have your doubt, because that's shaped by your own lenses. Maybe you fought in every relationship. Move that to curiosity. Instead, hey, you have tremendous curiosity. I can tell from your questions. So it's awesome. But curiosity in other people, in your own reality, when you're stepping into the marathon, what's going to come through? You know, who am I going to be on the other side? People ask me, who are you going to be on the other side of Antarctica? I have no idea, dude. And that's part of the joy, you know? So curiosity, courage, presence, and the other one is a sense of humor. You have to be able to laugh when shit gets bad. And this is what, this is huge. You have to be able to laugh, especially, laugh at all the things. I think it's a deeply flawed thing that I'm seeing in the world right now, where we demonize comedians for making quote-unquote offensive jokes. You should be able to laugh, especially at the dark shit. That's how you move through life, you know? So having a sense of humor is how I get through all the hard shit I do. You know, and there's obviously a series of other virtues, but I would say you train all those four and you master those, it'll guide you through life's struggles, you know? It'll guide you through everything. And then also be looking for one, this is not necessarily related to virtue, but talking about, it reminded me of the dualities. At any point in life, I'm looking for one duality causing me friction and I go play on the other edge of it. So, you know, I mentioned suffering and play. Or fun, right? I was struggling with that. I'm also, for a while, I was navigating the duality of control and surrender. I'm a giant control freak. A lot of us are, right? When my world is in my hands, I control my fate. Got it. Let me play on the edge of surrender. And the way I did that, I had a little notebook. Every time something kind of mystical happened, you know, we all have this experience whoa, so weird how that happened. Like, as an example, I did an 8-hour tire dragging session all night, one night in Scottsdale. I didn't want to go. I was like, this sucks. I just don't want to go. But I went out there. I was just kind of really miserable. An hour in, I see a woman with a dog that's half Arctic wolf.
Oh my God.
In freaking Scottsdale, Arizona. First time seen it, never seen it since. Arctic wolf, I consider my spirit animal. And it was like, holy shit. And this woman was so curious. We had a deep conversation for a little bit. And I saw this magnificent Arctic wolf looking dog. And I wrote it down, because that to me was training my muscle to believe in surrender, to believe in the mysticism of the universe. The darkness was an experience of surrender, right? So that was another duality I was working on. I actually went back to the duality of a kind of play and pleasure, pleasure and suffering, because I tend to lean more suffering. So sometimes you'll go find yourself going back to one. But I'm always looking at a duality. Like, another duality that I was playing with and I encourage people to play with is ego and humility. Ego is demonized as bad, the enemy. It's not the enemy. To do what I want to do, I have to believe I'm the hardest, toughest motherfucker alive. But I also have to have the humility to be a relentless learner. You know, so I was at a point where I was constantly kind of beating myself up, constantly thinking I'm unworthy. Valuable tool at times. So now I'm stepping into more ego. Let me own that shit. Let me own how badass I am. You know, so always looking for a duality. Find one. And this is going to take awareness. There's a lot to this, but I'll send you a list of dualities, because in my constant practice of all these things, I have a lot of time to think when I'm doing the shit I do. So when you're tired dragging for 9 hours, your mind has a lot of time to think. So I kind of come up with this huge list of dualities and I'll send it to you, and then just find one. And we won't get to a point where you kind of it's not like a magic X on the ground, like I've now mastered this, but you'll just know with enough, as long as you practice awareness. Like, even with surrender, I was like, I've actually found a way to now fully embrace the mysticism of the universe. Awesome. Now let me move on to the next duality.
I love that so much, because, you know, I like to tell people, it's like, I try to take peaceful people and make them more ambitious. And I try to make ambitious people a little more peaceful. But I never considered that what I'm actually doing is trying to expose them to the duality of life.
And love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, your wife or fiance said you are the most emotionally centered person someone will ever meet. And I really feel that from you. And I really feel a deep sense of peace within you, which is just like remarkable for somebody who has done all of the crazy stuff you've done. Like, to me, it's so cool.
Thank you,
man. And you mentioned presence as one of the most important pieces. And she said what she learned from you is presence is the key to amazing relationships, and presence is how you achieve greatness. How can somebody get better at training presence?
Keep practicing it in the mundane, in the day-to-day. Mm. When you're standing in a coffee shop, instead of checking your phone, pause. Let me be here. What am I feeling?
Let's
meditate.
Let's do a 30-second pause right now on this podcast. It's something that really centers you, right?
It does. Practice meditating, you know? And the thing with meditating, it's not about why people stop is they think that my mind's not still, so I'm failing at it.
Doing it wrong.
The goal is not to have stillness of mind the whole time. The goal is to keep bringing it back to stillness. Mm. So a simple mantra I use when I meditate is bring it back. Super simple, nothing fancy. My mind will wander, bring it back. Got it. Now I'm still again. Mind will wander, bring it back. Now I'm still again. The more you do it, the better you get at it. Like now I can do meditations and my mind will be still for a while before the thought arises, then I bring it back. And I'm able to sit in that stillness, but that comes with practice. And you have to train yourself to do that. You know, your mind is going to wander, especially doing things like marathon. You might be like mile five in the sock or something, now thinking about the end. That's the perfect time. And it's very hard to do. You'll have to do it repeatedly. Like when I was in the darkness, the 10 days, you know, we're filming a documentary around the Antarctic crossing. So the documentary crew was the ones going to come get me out of the darkness. And I had no sense of time, right? You have no sense of time in the dark. So I actually misread the time. In my mind, I thought they should be coming kind of any minute. Turns out it wasn't for at least 12 hours. I don't know exactly, but like totally misjudged that. So the whole time, and the crazy thing is there was a hurricane about to hit in Mexico where I did this. So there would be constant like a tree hitting the door. The only time in the 10 days was right towards the end. And I kept thinking the tree hitting the door is the knock, and it wasn't.
Oh my God.
And that kept bringing me out of presence. And I kept saying, okay, I noticed myself waiting for that door to open now. Got it. Let me bring it back. And a great way to bring presence is also gratitude. There's beauty, like especially in that darkness. I've chosen to be here. And there was like great insights in the last 12 hours in that darkness, you know? So sitting with that, all right, God, I'm going to feel so grateful. Because after this moment is over. I'm never getting this moment back, you know, never getting it back. Mm. Got it. Let me feel truly grateful for it. Let me bring it back. What's the value here? Sitting with that. Now you bring yourself into the present. And then later on, the mind wanders again. Now you do it again, you know? But the more you do it, the better you get at it. The better you train yourself to be with the isness of this moment.
What did volunteering at a California state prison teach you?
It taught me the heartbreaking truth of reality of how little we have control over our fate. There were guys in that prison, like they did a beautiful exercise in there. I went there with my friend Jordan Harbinger, who kind of set this up, and it was a tremendously, profoundly beautiful experience. You know, they did this exercise called they had a line, and the men who were incarcerated were on one side, and all of us volunteers were on the other. And they'd ask all these questions like, how many of you have you seen somebody being shot before you were 10 years old? And almost universally, the men who were incarcerated would come up there. Have you lost one parent or both parents universally on that side? And they asked all these questions about factors that we could not individually control. If I was born where they were born, I would almost certainly be exactly where they are. And that was heartbreaking to see. You know, these men, they were quote-unquote gangbangers, right? Like, we define them by these things. When a young kid grew up in that horrifically violent neighborhood, they did one action that they're now defined for the rest of their life. And here they were in prison, maximum security prison. Like, one guy told me the day before we came, somebody got shanked in the yard, like kind of like the movies. And they're trying to get out of that world. You know, we all know the value of surrounding yourself in a positive environment. Now imagine trying to do that when everything around you is horrifically violent and negative. If you leave that gang, you're now ousted, right? Like, and it was heartbreaking to see that, and also beautiful to see how strong these people were. Like, you channel some of those people, they've been through more shit than most of us can fathom. Like, one guy had been in solitary for like 20 years, separate from the whole conversation about the prison system. I won't even delve into that. But like, that power of his mind, you channel that shit. You channel how much, because the greater the darkness, the greater the light, right? And even like, you know, so you see that. You see how much these people had suffered. And if that channeled, they would be warriors, man. They would be warriors, you know? And that was very heartbreaking to see. But it was inspiring to see how strong these people were. And we don't, you know, while we often are a slave to our circumstances beyond our control, unfortunately, when you find yourself in prison, you have a lot less agency over controlling it, you know? But most of us who are not trapped in literally our freedom sort of imposed upon, we have agency over seizing the reins, you know? We are slaves to a reality that's beyond our control. We're all affected by the paradigms that shaped us. But the moment you bring that awareness in, the moment you step in and regain agency, one of my favorite quotes on the nature of consciousness that I think is summarizes beautifully is from this guy, P.D. Uspensky. He wrote this book, The Psychology of Man's Possible Evolution. He says, man is a machine, but a very peculiar machine. He is a machine that when recognizing he is a machine can cease to be a machine. Mm. Now, explaining that, what that means is we are a machine in that if somebody comes into this room with a gun, I'm going to feel fear. Mm. I'm not choosing it. That's a response to stimuli. That's coming back to everything I said about the constructs, our beliefs, right? But the moment I step in, the moment I recognize that's the first dart, and instead of letting that downward spiral control, like this of second dart, what I call in the book second dart syndrome, where our thoughts just go on spiral without our awareness, the moment I step in and say, got it, I'm feeling fear, I'm going to regain agency. By recognizing the limitations of free will, kind of paradoxically, we regain free will. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
That's and again, coming back to the prison, like that was, they had much less agency because they were now placed in a position through one action that doesn't define who they were, but they were still in control of their attitude in response to that. And that was awe-inspiring.
How do you then take that situation in your day-to-day life to help yourself in any way?
It gives you a lot more perspective. You know, even all the things from that experience to being at war, like I said, working with former child soldiers, it gives you perspective on your own stuff. And this doesn't mean you're not allowed to feel bad. Like, I want to be very clear because even my mom, you know, now they have a very great life. They have a great life in India. They have a lot of money, and my dad's worked hard for it, and so is my mom. But now, so she'll be like, my life is so good, I have no right to feel bad.
Yeah.
And that's not the point of this. Exactly.
People do that.
People do that. And that's not the point of this. It's okay to feel bad, no matter how good your life is. And it's the resistance of that actually makes it worse.
Yeah.
The point of getting that perspective is not to demonize or not to resist the feeling bad. It's actually to help you transcend it. Like, got it, I am feeling bad now. Life is great, but I'm still allowed to have a bad day. We're human beings. Don't resist or deny that. That's coming back to everything we started with, the acceptance of the isness. The acceptance of isness is so foundational. You know, even like when I was skiing in the Arctic earlier this year, I got hammered with 2 days of polar storms, and the snow was very soft after that because it was just being a lot of snow and storms. And as I was dragging this heavy sled up through soft snow, up in this undulating terrain, I kept saying, thank you, God, for these perfect conditions. Because everything is perfect in its isness, for it cannot be anything other than what it already is. I'm going to say that again.
Please.
This is huge. Everything is perfect in its isness, for it cannot be anything other than what it already is. So even when I'm on expedition, I trick my brain. I'll say things like, instead of saying, I hope there's no storm tomorrow, I hope it's cold, I hope it's warmer, I'll say, I hope the weather will be what it is tomorrow. Yes. 100% of the time, I get what I want. 100% of the time, right? So acceptance of isness, not just in the external stimuli, but even in the internal reality. Because we don't control most of our internal reality, the thoughts, the feelings, but you have to become awareness of it and then accept it. Then you can transcend it. So perspective is just a tool to transcend.
And on this point, if your reality is dictated by what the weather is outside, that's a great place to start. It's a sunny day, great. It's a rainy day, great. It's
exactly.
A snowy day. Like, you can do this right now if you catch yourself in some way saying, this day is this way because of things that I can't control. Just relax into the isness, because 32 billion years got us to this moment.
Exactly.
I'm pretty sure it's accurate.
Exactly.
I'm pretty sure it's the way it is supposed to be.
It's perfect. Exactly. Exactly.
And this podcast is the way it is supposed to be too. And I'm so grateful for it. You're an absolute legend.
Oh, thank you, brother.
Like, I really mean that from the bottom of my heart.
Thank
you. The peace, the ambition, the willingness to strive for all you can be, your attitude, you've got a yes and attitude. This is something that I've been thinking about. It's like the best people are yes and. Mm-hmm. Yes and people are like, yes, what you said is accurate and also this.
Mm-hmm.
And you are a yes and person. And so I'm very grateful for that.
Thank you, brother.
What should we leave people with as a challenge by way of, you listened to us talk for the last hour. What is going on? What should somebody take from this and actually do something with it in their own life? What's a challenge that comes to mind for you?
I would say the best thing to go do based on this entire conversation we've had Just go lock yourself in a dark room for an hour. Or if that's an hour's too much, 30.
No, do an hour. Do an hour.
It should challenge you.
Yes.
It should make you feel horribly uncomfortable. But when you start going still, when you start being with that stillness, you will open doors within yourself that you've never opened before. And the key thing is, when you open those doors, this is why meditation is not always peaceful. You're not just opening doors and sunshine, rainbows, and unicorns are coming out. You're also going to have the dragons and the demons, right? But as one of my many mantras, the greater your demons, the greater the divinity required to rise above them. The greater your demons, the greater the divinity required to rise above them.
Mm.
But you have to bring those demons to the surface so they don't control you, because they will control you if you don't control them, if you don't be with them. Stillness is how you do it.
Wow.
Sit in a dark room for an hour.
The fact that you've gone to war, ultra events, Antarctica, what do you come back to? You come back to just be in a room for an hour and let that guide you, because don't listen to us. You've got the truth for you. Like, and I think more people need to hear that. Like, someone could look at your story, they could look at what you've done, and they could say, that guy's on a mountain. That guy is above me in some way. He's a superhero. And you are a superhero, but you're also a human being. And you started just like everyone starts, with a blank slate of excitement and possibility. And admittedly, not everyone gets that opportunity of the blank slate. Some people are below surface level to begin with.
Yeah.
But you took what the gifts that you've been given, and you aim for more. So thank you for being you. Thank you for doing that. I'm very grateful for you. And where should we send people to help you with your mission and connect with you further?
Thank you for asking. You can find Fearvana on Instagram. I'm at Fearvana, F-E-A-R-V-A-N-A. The book is on Amazon, Kindle, paperback, Audible, all of that. We've been donating all the profits of the book to charity. We've helped, survivors of sex trafficking, helped to build a school. Right now, we're funneling it all to The Crossing. Again, I'm not making a dollar off it. And then also the website, greatsoulcrossing.com. That's great, S-O-U-L, crossing. We have a crowdfunding campaign for the Antarctic Crossing, and on there for different donation tiers. Like one of the donation tiers, I have a deep dive on all the method acting. I have 6 hours of training on the method acting that I've done, deep dives training, and every piece of mindset tool I've developed over decades of playing on these edges is that you get access to for donating XYZ on the, I have a different tool of 25 weapons to navigate the pain cave, both emotional, physical, different tools. So as donations, one is like, thank you. I'm truly grateful for it. It makes a difference. The crossing costs $750K. So I need all the support I can get. We've raised $200K so far, but I have a ways to go. And then just as my way of thank you, there's access to different stuff, including Fearvana Fuel, which I gave you in the book, and signed books, things like that for a donation. So you can find that on Great Soul Crossing.
Awesome. And that's all linked down below for people who want to check it out.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.